Welcome back. You are listening to Steele Talking. I'm your host, Geraldine Steele. Okay, first of all, from Dallas to Las Vegas to Eastern Kentucky, we've been hearing about the severe and deadly flooding that has been all over the news recently. Now, does it have you wondering if your property and possessions are covered with insurance? Well, the Minnesota DNR has a place you can go to find help. To give us more details about it, we welcome DNR State Floodplain Manager Seal Strauss to the program, courtesy of the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline. Welcome, Seal. How are you, sir?
Ma'am. I'm
Oh,
doing
ma'am!
Well.
Oh, my gosh! Bravo! That is great news. Okay, so are you the first woman to take this position?
In this position in Minnesota, but many of my counterparts in other states are female. So there's actually quite a few of us in floodplain management that are female.
Do you love it?
I do enjoy it. It's such an important area, trying to reduce risk for people, trying to make them safer when there are floods, be able to bounce back when there's flooding in their community. Such important part of helping people avoid those kinds of damages and losses.
The amazing thing is that insurance changes so often. A lot of us don't really remember or not reminded to go and just check to see if you still have that same insurance. You know, talk to your insurance people and say, you know, if it's your home or something like this. But what the DNR does with the floodplain is what I'm really interested in. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. Looking at the bigger picture, it's FEMA tends to refer to it as their three-legged or four-legged stool because for reducing risk, we've got flood insurance is just a part of it, making flood insurance available that's nationally backed. But then also we have identification of the higher risk areas, the FEMA flood maps. We have regulations at the local level that are based on state and federal minimum requirements so that new buildings that are built safer and not in a way that they're shoving more water on other people. And then also there's, especially in the last 20, 30 years, there's been more of an effort to reduce that existing risk with grants to help communities do buyouts of those more at-risk buildings or to build the big flood control projects, and also some federal grants. So that working all those things together.
Right. And we have to work with them all together. That's for sure. We need to. However, I must say, I actually talked about this about 3 years ago. Where is FEMA? Right. You've mentioned FEMA. I know FEMA is very important when it comes to climate crisis as well as floods and so much more. But I don't hear that anymore. I don't hear FEMA is here. FEMA is there. They're going to make sure that the people are taken care of. We're going to make sure we get them to a safe space. And so you work with FEMA sometimes, right? You get to connect with them and find out what they're offering and what are the updates. You get to do that. Tell me if FEMA is as strong to you as it always has been.
It is, and we are partners with them, so we're representing FEMA for many things. We're the go-between with the local officials. But when there is a bigger disaster, when there's a presidential declaration, that's right. When FEMA really comes in and helps. So luckily, it's good news that we're not hearing about FEMA around Minnesota, because that means that we're not getting those huge storms and damage that they're seeing in other parts of the country. And we've had some really big storms, but because we've done a really good job of keeping people out of those areas and local communities have done a great job of buying out those most at-risk people and putting in flood control projects. A couple recent examples in Rochester in 2019, they had a big storm, a big rain that was nearly as big or similar magnitude to the one they had in 78 that was devastating. But since then, they put in a bunch of reservoirs and done a lot of other improvements. So when the big rain came, all the media was reporting about were some cows that got washed into a stream and a guy that got trapped on a picnic table. And yeah. Thank goodness they weren't talking about all the major damage. But FEMA is very busy in other parts of the country with recent big storms.
So a lot of the flooding that is happening around the country, we're hearing that these floods have been so devastating that they don't even know if we can come back from it, right? See, here in Minnesota, we used to have two rivers that would really overflow. It would reach that high point that we didn't want it ever to reach. And that has been a problem. What do you see now, though, with all of the rain that is happening during the spring months? And then here we are looking at the fall. We will also get more water. So are we as prepared as we need to be, even though we are not flooding all the time? We don't have to worry. We kind of just put it behind our minds. But I'm the one saying, if you own a home, please make sure you have the insurance. So tell me about the rivers, and then tell me what it is we need to do to make sure that we have the insurance.
Sure. Well, the rivers, we still are worried about the rivers, that if we get up above historic levels, it could damage a lot of buildings. So communities, they have response plans. They're doing the projects to reduce what risk they can. They're trying to be prepared for when there is a bigger flood. Certainly the social media, they can get the word out better.
Ms. Strauss, do you mind if I, yeah. I apologize for interrupting. We absolutely have to go to Paul Douglas, our meteorologist, who wants to know if we can cut in with a quick segment about the weather that is happening right now. We'll be right back with you in a moment. Now we're going to continue our conversation with Cecile Strauss. She is the State Floodplain Manager for Minnesota DNR. Welcome back. I do apologize having to break in, but of course it was quite remarkable, Cecile, that you and I are talking about this flooding and how we have been so blessed in Minnesota, and now we're looking at tornadoes tonight. Amazing.
Right. And any kind of event is important to be prepared for and listen to the folks who are giving you the warnings.
But well, thank you for your patience. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You had asked about the big rivers, and certainly we continue to be concerned about flooding on the big rivers. Those tend to be the spring floods, where we do more likely have a couple weeks of warning because of the gauges and forecasting that the National Weather Service and NOAA does. But in the recent decades, more and more of our storms are big storms, 6 inches, 8 inches, 10 inches, even 14 inches, that come in other parts of the year, not just in the spring. They can go from any time in the spring through the fall. And that's becoming a bigger concern for many areas of the state. And when we talk about flood insurance, and I wanted to get back to there because that's what you had asked about earlier.
Right.
Flood insurance in your normal home insurance that you have for fire, hail, tornadoes, that doesn't cover, in most cases, it doesn't cover damage due to flooding. You have to get a separate flood insurance policy. And the main source of those flood insurance policies is through the National Flood Insurance Program. And that came about in the late 60s, in 1968. The act was passed for the regulations, the mapping, the flood insurance, because private insurers, you have a big flood come, they tend to have their policies in one area, and it just, they couldn't cover all those damages due to flooding. So they're spreading out the risk. They have this national flood insurance, but a lot of people don't realize that it's not covered by their normal home insurance. And you do have
to. I am a witness to that.
Buy it. Okay.
Yeah. You can buy it, but Cecile, that happened to me in the 90s. And let me tell you, you know, we were on a hill as well, and the water was coming down like a river. And I called for insurance, and they said to me, you would have to literally have all of downtown St. Paul in underwater before we would give you this benefit or this policy. So here we are today, and we're seeing the climate change. We're witnessing it. What is the process for us to go after the insurance? How do we begin?
You actually normally can talk to the same person, the same agency where you get your auto or home insurance. In most cases, they can get you a flood insurance policy. They're able to do that. Or you can contact FEMA's, you can go to their website, floodsmart.org, or .gov is a good place to find agents in the area, but I would start with your own agent. They may need to talk to a specialist within their agency at their headquarters or something, but most flood insurance policies are sold through the normal agents that you deal with for your home and your auto.
And many years ago, excuse me for interrupting, but many years ago, we actually had the opportunity to try to get some insurance, and people could do it quickly. Nowadays, does it take a long process for you to get it?
It doesn't take that long for them to get the process, to get the policy in place. But if you're getting a new loan, you can get a policy right away, or your new mortgage. But if you're just going out and buying a policy, there's a 30-day waiting period. So if you hear on the news that you're going to get a big flood in 2 days, you can't rush out and get a policy because it does have that 30-day waiting period before it's effective.
And then
another
finally,
warning.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, is that the policies are sold for the building and then separately for contents. So folks that have their buildings in the high-risk mapped floodplain, there's a national requirement that they must get flood insurance. Their lenders will require them to get flood insurance. And a lot of times they just get it for the building because that's what the lender's making them do. But people want to be aware that you want to get it for both the building and your stuff. And a lot of the agents, the two biggest myths are agents telling people they can't get flood insurance because they're not in the mapped area. And that's absolutely not true. If you're in a participating community, over 95% of the people in Minnesota can get a flood insurance policy, no matter where you are in the community. And then the other thing is not knowing that they can get content coverage.
You talked about mortgage. Let's talk about the homes that are old, you know, from the 1930s and 1920s up to today, and then versus the newer homes. Does the insurance change at all?
It will be rated differently depending on how high the buildings were built and where they were built. So a lower building, it's going to be more expensive for the insurance if they're in a higher risk area. A newer building, especially built in the last 50 years, should have been built higher, should have been built outside the riskiest areas. So that flood insurance should be cheaper.
My goodness, I've learned a lot from you tonight, Seal. Thank you so much for joining us. Is there any other piece of advice that is really important for the homeowners or those that are in the buildings that don't trust it, that sort of thing? Is there anything else you could say to those who are looking at getting flood insurance?
Boy, look at whether you're in a low area. It's not just people next to big rivers. There's a lot of low stormwater areas that that people may not realize that they're at risk, and it's a good idea to get it.
I live over North Minneapolis, and it used to be a rainforest in this area. It's many years ago, and I often look and see some of the water is now being captured more in certain areas than I've ever seen. So, yeah, you know, we have to all stay on top of this. I'm so happy that you are a part of the MNDNR. And as a the state floodplain manager, I'm excited to have you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right. I hope to have you on again and be a little longer. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Yes. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. As you've already heard, we are updating, getting an update from Paul Douglas, of course, and Jonathan Lowe. We'll keep you posted on the weather tonight. Make sure that you pay attention. That's important. My next guest I'm excited about because, of course, the number of women working in STEM-related careers is on the rise. That makes me so happy. But according to the Census Bureau, women still make up just 27% of the STEM workforce. In physics, the number is even lower, where females are outnumbered 4-1. Females, should say women, goodness. Julie Hogan is a professor of physics and engineering at Bethel University. She's here to talk about the importance of women's voices and perspectives in this area of science. Thank you so much for joining us, Julie Hogan. Really appreciate you being patient.
Thanks. No problem. Physics on display tonight in the weather.
I tell you, my goodness, and forgive us if we have to break in for more weather. Understood. But I want to start out by asking you about your background and how you have been led to this incredible movement of STEM.
Well, I am a high-energy particle physicist, and what that means is that I like to study the particles and the forces that make up our universe, especially if we're talking about, like, right at the beginning of the universe, which sounds very abstract, but involves much more hands-on work than you would think. So I got my undergraduate and PhD degree in physics, and then I joined an experiment at the CERN laboratory that's in Switzerland to do research. So I wasn't actually even sure that I wanted to be a professor until a friend of mine, we were eating lunch, and he tells me about, you know, an opportunity to apply at Bethel, where I'm working now, and I decided to give it a shot. You know, I was like, what's the worst that could happen? So I gave it a shot, and I have just loved the chance to work with students and teach them physics. It's super motivating to watch young people get excited about the things that I love.
How young are we talking?
Like,
how young? Yeah, like what ages are you teaching?
In fact, we start class tomorrow morning, and so I will have a room full of probably about 17 to 19-year-olds.
Wow, that's awesome. Bravo. They need it. We need it. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. Why do you feel the number of women in physics is so low? Because it's been low for a long time, but now it's eking up. How low is it considering the numbers of men that are a part of STEM?
It has been low for a long time. You're exactly right. I was just reflecting that actually the percentage that you were mentioning, 4-1, is basically accurate, and that's not very different from when I was in college, which was shockingly to me already like 15 to 20 years ago. And so it's on the rise, but very slowly. And we're already seeing that in our college students, our undergraduate students, we're seeing that 4-1 ratio. So this is coming from choices that young women make when they're teenagers, when they're in high school. And part of that is going to be awareness. People are drawn to what their parents do. People are drawn to what they're, you know, what they see adults doing around them. Mm-hmm. And then part of that is probably also very driven by just not feeling part of the group, not seeing yourself in the group.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing for me. Yeah. Forgive me for interrupting, but here's the thing for me. I get so frustrated when young women are discouraged to get into STEM and discouraged to learn more about physics and move up and up and up so they can get those high-paying jobs that bring them such joy as well. It's frustrating, and that's what I'm concerned about. We are seeing an increase, yes, but will we continue to see an increase in these young women that really, really want to be a part of STEM?
Well, and one of the things we've heard is that talking to some of these women who are coming to college, what they're drawn to is wanting to make an impact on people. They want to help people. And that's a repeating phrase we hear over and over. I want to help people. And so when you look at STEM disciplines like biology or social sciences, the ratios are often much better. There are many more women able to participate equitably in those fields. And so one of the things we have to do as physicists is work on helping people understand that you can help people through physics. Like, I was actually thinking, these storm chasers they were just talking to have probably studied a lot of physics, and now here they are helping people avoid the storms.
Right.
Anytime you go you go out and you have an x-ray, have you ever had an x-ray at the doctor? Well, that doctor and nurse are the ones, you know, helping you with your problem. But the engineers are the ones who designed their machine and software to take that x-ray for you. And the particle physicist 130 years ago who discovered an x-ray just doing fundamental experiments in a laboratory is what we have to thank for that all these years later. So you can still help people, but it's a little less direct.
Well, this past summer, I believe you led a group of students and alumni as you participated virtually in the 10th anniversary of the Higgs discovery. Could you tell us what that's about?
Absolutely. So we, you know, it's an example of one of the opportunities that you can have as a college student studying physics. About 10 years ago in high energy physics, we discovered at the CERN experiments a particle that we call the Higgs boson. And it's kind of the capstone of our current model of all the particles and forces in the universe and how they hang together and interact with each other. So for us, that was just a humongous milestone. And the fact that we're already 10 years out from that is, it was just jaw-dropping, and we had to pause and celebrate. So we had students, faculty members, alumni call in on Zoom with all of the other United States universities who work on this same same experiment. That's like 50 universities. So we had a huge number of institutions and people joined on this Zoom so that we could hear lectures and reflections and things about this particle. It was really exciting.
What do you think you could possibly do to help these young people once they get involved and they love it until someone starts discouraging them, or maybe they don't have as much time, or maybe they're getting distracted with other options? What would you say to them to help keep them going up and further when it comes to STEM? This is so important. And by the way, I look at those Google doodles all the time, and I am amazed when they're talking about women from 100 years ago who were big in physics. We never heard about them. I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't hear about all of these women doing these great things. But today, young people are hearing about women doing great things. So what would you say to them now to keep them on the track?
Absolutely. I would say two main things. I would say, first of all, if this is something you're excited about, lean in. There are so many research opportunities. There is no, women do not need to feel behind the ball game in doing active research, especially when you're a young college student. Just this summer, my experiment, the CMS experiment, has added two internships that were specific for groups who are underrepresented in physics, and other experiments in other fields of physics are doing the same thing. So the opportunities are out there. Lean into that and recognize that doing those types of things is going to build so many skills that are transferable to getting a job. So don't ever worry that you can't get a job with a physics degree not many people worry about that with an engineering degree, but even with physics, people are out there wanting to hire students coming out with the skills in programming and critical thinking and problem solving that you get from doing research in physics. And the second piece of advice I would give is to get a mentor. Find other students to keep connected with. Find a professor or a teacher that you trust who you can just, talk to, get advice from. Find a mentor.
Are there teachers that are skilled in making sure that they stay on top of students that are absolutely involved in wanting to know more and more about physics? Or are we really challenged by not having enough counselors or enough teachers that know enough about physics to really stay on top of it? Because the older these students get, the more they're going to know. And maybe it may be difficult for some of the teachers to stay on top of that. And if so, if it is hard to hold on to them or what they're learning now, what do we do about it to make sure that they stay on top of it?
Well, I would point people to their high school physics and other science teachers. I think those people are very, their voices are not heard loudly enough in our field, honestly. My first and most important mentor in my becoming a physicist was my high school chemistry teacher. I was open with him about my interests and my excitement, and he recognized that it was not chemistry but physics. And so he, did a lot of work to get doors open for me. So I think your high school STEM teachers, they have a lot to offer in terms of helping, and they have a lot of connections with the universities in their area so that they can help students get where they need to be.
Julie Hogan, you are quite remarkable. I am honored to have you on tonight. Professor of Business and Engineering at Bethel University. Congratulations. I hope you continue to love it. It's a lot of work and you seem to be up for it. So I hope to join us again in the next year, okay?
All right.
Okay, we're going to take a break and come back and wrap up this hour in just a moment. It is now 8:55 here at WCCO. Welcome back as we wrap up this hour. I do want to make a statement about what Professor said. She said, we all have a stake in the universe. Okay. That's it. We all have a stake in the universe. Even though a lot of the work we do involves math and there isn't a lot of ambiguity when you're working with numbers, having multiple perspectives continually helps us assess and determine the important work that we are doing. And we are talking about women, girls that are getting involved in STEM. They are learning about physics and they love it. We want to keep them there. We want to encourage them to keep going. Because remember, there were those that came way before them and they will honor them. I know they will. They will move forward, and I can't wait to see all that they can be, all that they can do while they're working so hard to meet their goals. And I must say, Jonathan, my niece that was just in town, her son, my great nephew, is so brilliant. He's 14 or 15 years old and absolutely brilliant. Companies and corporations are coming after him and schools are coming after him asking if he will come to their school. It's remarkable. It's never too late. If you have a girl in your life, a daughter in your life, a niece in your life, make sure you give them an opportunity to know what STEM is all about and that they can actually be a part of it. So we may think that it's not important, but it is. Thank you, Professor Julie Hogan, for joining us. She's professor of business and engineering at Bethel University. Now, of course, coming up next, we are absolutely going to go right into Center Stage. And I absolutely love that hour, period. It's a time for us to talk about arts and entertainment. And we have got some great guests tonight. So thank you so much, Jonathan, for booking the 2 hours we have just gone through. And of course, coming up next is Center Stage and then the Mom and Michael Hour. Yes, he will be joining us. We'll be back.